Okay, so there's this pretty incredible story, right? About a guy, Martin Weiss's father,
No,
actually.
yeah. What about him?
Yeah, during the Great Depression, he didn't just, get by, he apparently made a fortune. Twice.
Wow, twice during the Depression.
By betting against the market, like betting it would go down when everyone else
Yeah.
is, well, probably thinking the opposite.
That takes some serious nerve, especially back then. Seems totally counterintuitive.
Exactly. Must have sounded completely nuts, right? And that contrarian idea is really what we're diving into today.
Right, looking at how you might maybe find opportunities when markets get rocky.
Yeah, we're digging into the book Crash Profits by Martin Weiss. And our mission for you listening is basically to pull out the key ideas. How do you spot potential risks? Maybe even see opportunities without, getting totally bogged down in finance speak.
Definitely. And we should say the book uses some stories, some fictional characters to illustrate things. But we're going to focus on the factual stuff it brings up, the real events, the analysis behind it all.
Good point. So let's jump right in. His father, back before the Depression crash, what was he seeing? What signals made him think, uh-oh, trouble ahead, and take those really unconventional bets?
Well, the book points to a couple of key things. First, a big disconnect. You had this booming stock market,
Yeah.
but the underlying economy actually getting weaker. He saw businesses struggling, and importantly, he saw markets in Europe already turning down.
So like a global warning sign the US was ignoring.
Pretty much. And second, huge amounts of leverage. Lots of people had borrowed heavily to buy stocks,
Okay.
which just makes the whole system incredibly fragile if things start to fall, you know?
Yeah, that makes sense. Debt and a disconnect from reality. Sounds familiar sometimes, doesn't it? Okay, so the book then jumps forward a bit, tells this story about a woman investing in a company, UCBS,
Yep, UCBS.
based on her broker being super enthusiastic, saying strong buy,
Yeah.
even appearing on CNBC, hyping it up. Classic Wall Street enthusiasm, maybe.
It's used as a really clear example of potential conflicts of interest. The broker's main motivation, as the book presents it, keep her money invested, keep her as a client.
Even if selling was the right move for her.
Exactly. Selling might mean losing her business. And the book really hammers this point. Analysts, the ones making these recommendations, their pay often isn't tied directly to how accurate their picks are.
Wait, really? That seems completely backwards. They can be wrong and still get paid well.
That's the implication. And it brings up the real-life Elliot Spitzer investigation into Merrill Lynch. Remember that?
Vaguely, yeah. What did they find?
Well, they found this shocking difference. Publicly, Merrill was rating stocks like Infospace, Excite at Home, dot-com era stuff as buy or accumulate.
Okay.
But internally, in emails, they were calling them piece of junk, piece of shesh, seriously. Yeah. And investors who trusted those public ratings, they got crushed, lost like 99% sometimes. So the takeaway is this fundamental misalignment, right? The buy rating wasn't always about what was best for the investor.
Wow. That's a disturbing reality check. And it wasn't just Merrill Lynch, was it? The book lists other examples. Analysts keeping buy ratings on stocks like Optical Communications Products, Sprint PCS, Corvus, even as they were tanking.
It paints a picture of a system where, the incentives can be really skewed, especially if the investment bank is also involved in underwriting the stock.
Yeah.
They want positive ratings.
Creates a serious bias, doesn't
A
it?
huge bias potential, yeah.
Okay, so back to UCBS, the company this woman invested in. It wasn't just bad luck or market sentiment, right? The book talks about problems inside the company, misconduct, shady accounting.
Oh, yeah. UCBS, in the book's telling, grew super fast by buying other companies, but
Right.
they funded it with a ton of debt. Like by late 99, $5 of debt for every $1 of capital, and hardly any cash to cover near-term debts. Very vulnerable.
So the CEO was under pressure.
Immense pressure. Keep the image shiny, keep the stock price up, attract more money to handle that debt. UCBS was the ticker, by the way.
Right. And this pressure led to some questionable stuff, especially around executive pay and financial reporting.
Totally. The book talks about stock options. Great way for executives to get rich without hitting the reported profits directly. And at UCBS, there was apparently a plan to quadruple executive options. Plus, it mentions companies using legal maneuvers, though maybe not so legal later, to shift debt and losses off the main books.
It lists a whole bunch: Adelphia, Computer Associates, Global Crossing, Halliburton, Lucent, Quest, Tyco. Sounds like this was happening all over.
It was a feature of that era, definitely. Some illegal, some just aggressive accounting.
And derivatives, too. Those always sound complicated.
Yeah, the book simplifies it. Basically, companies could create custom private derivatives. Hard to value, not much disclosure. Lots of room to make the books look better than they were, hiding the real risk.
So, messy books. Lots of debt. Were people inside raising alarms? You mentioned that research assistant, Tamara Belmont.
Yeah, Tamara. She was an economist at the brokerage covering UCBS. And she saw big problems early on. Privately called it a disaster on wheels.
Why disaster on wheels?
Too much debt, not enough real assets, earnings looked inflated to her. But when she tried to get her boss to downgrade the stock, resistance?
Ah, that pressure again. Don't upset the client company.
Pretty much. Bad for the firm's business relationship.
And then the market turns down and all this hidden stuff starts coming out, like the pension fund crisis. That caught people off guard, didn't it?
Big time. The market plunge in the early 2000s really exposed how badly underfunded many company pension plans were.
Like who?
Oh, big names. GM, Exxon, Ford, Delphi, Delta, lots of them. Billions short in their pension funds compared to what they owed retirees.
And wasn't there this extra twist where some companies had actually used pension surpluses during the good times to make their earnings look better?
Exactly. They'd booked expected future gains from the pension fund as current income, looked great on paper when the market was booming, but when the market tanked, those paper gains turned into very real deficits. Double whammy.
Ouch. And the book mentions Adelphi again. Undisclosed debt. Auditors missing it.
Yeah, $2.3 billion in hidden debt. Auditors gave it a clean bill of health. Really shows the weakness in oversight back then.
It really points towards, well, a lot of executive greed and maybe not much accountability. The UCBS CEO getting nervous as scandals broke elsewhere. WorldCom, Tyco.
Right. Those stories of outrageous spending, fraud, it made everyone nervous. But the book argues the accounting at UCBS was just the tip of the iceberg.
What was underneath?
The real killers were the massive debt and, crucially, deflationary pressures starting to build in the economy, falling prices, slowing demand.
And that hit UCBS directly.
Yeah, there was a Goldman Sachs survey showing IT spending was dropping. Bad news for UCBS's business and PCs, telecom, wireless. Eventually, the CEO resigned. Tamara Belmont left, too.
Okay, so the market's a mess. Companies look shaky. What does the book say you should do to protect yourself? First step sounds blunt. Sell the most vulnerable companies.
Pretty direct, yeah.
How do you know which ones are vulnerable?
They used the Weiss investment ratings. Specifically looked for companies rated E+ or D. Really weak ratings.
Based on what?
Things like too much debt, not enough capital cushion, poor earnings history. They list examples like PMC Sierra, Regeneron, Rite Aid. The idea is simple. Get rid of the weakest links first.
Makes sense. And they kept asking this core question. Are we still in a bear market? Knowing the overall trend is key, right?
Absolutely fundamental. You have to know which way the tide is flowing. And the book really pushes back against just blindly trusting your broker.
Yeah, like maybe your grandparents' advice. Be careful.
Exactly that kind of vibe. Do your own homework. Be critical. Assess the risk yourself.
Okay, so if you sell vulnerable stuff, where do you put the money? The book gets specific. Treasury only, money market funds? Why those?
Safety, basically. They invest only in short-term U.S. Treasury stuff. Super safe.
Safer than regular money markets?
Generally, yeah, because they avoid corporate debt. Plus, you usually get FDIC insurance. And here's a kicker. The income is often free from state and local taxes.
Oh, interesting. So safety and the tax break. It lists some examples, too.
Yeah, Scudder, T. Rowe Price, Vanguard. Some well-known names have them.
And sticking with bonds for a second, it explains why rising interest rates make bond prices fall. That can trip people up.
Yeah, it's inverse. Think about it. If you own a bond paying 3% and new ones come out paying 5%.
Nobody wants your old 3% bond.
All right, unless you sell it cheaper to make up the difference. So rates go up, prices of existing bonds go down.
Okay, and it distinguishes between bonds, notes, bills. Just treasury bills are safest.
Yeah, T-bills are very short-term, less affected by rate changes because they mature quickly. Bonds are longer-term, notes are in the middle. T-bills are seen as the safest haven within government debt.
Got it. Now, the book makes a pretty explosive claim after this. It says the federal government was running the greatest accounting fraud of all with a budget deficit. Whoa!
Yeah, that's strong language.
What's the argument?
It contrasts the official treasurer announcement for 2001, a $127 billion surplus, with what the book claims was the real deficit, $623.8 billion, even bigger in 2002.
How could the numbers be so different?
They point to the Federal Reserve's own data. Table F4 in the Z.1 report, tracking total government borrowing. The argument is the official surplus used specific accounting methods that didn't reflect the actual increase in total government debt.
So manipulating the presentation.
That's the accusation, making the picture look rosier than the underlying borrowing suggested.
And part of this involved raiding Social Security. How does that work?
Okay, so the idea is Social Security takes in taxes. If there's extra cash beyond immediate payouts, the government takes that cash, spends it elsewhere, and gives the Social Security Trust Fund, an IOU, a special government bond.
So the cash is gone, replaced by a promise to pay later.
Right. And the worry is, with huge deficits and potentially rising interest rates, those IOUs and government bonds in general could come under pressure. Maybe even a bond market crisis, like in 79-80.
Okay. So from government debt, we pivot to another potential bubble, real estate. The book talks about hypey real estate agents. That feels timeless.
Doesn't it? Always someone saying it's the best time to buy.
What were the red flags the book saw in real estate back then?
There's an analyst warning about home equity levels being really low historically, like lowest in maybe 50 years.
Meaning people didn't own much of their homes outright. Lots of mortgage debt.
Exactly. And this analyst predicted a three-phase real estate collapse. They also pushed back on the idea that money leaving stocks would just pour into real estate.
Why not? Seems logical.
Because stock market losses were so huge, people didn't necessarily have tons of cash freed up to suddenly buy houses.
Good point. So for you listening, if you own property, the book suggested thinking about your retirement plans and checking for bubble zones.
It pointed people to the OFEO website, now it's the FHFA, to check the house price index for their area.
I look for what?
A big jump in prices, like 25% or more over the last 5 years. That kind of rapid run-up could signal a bubble, meaning a higher risk of prices falling back down.
Okay, practical advice there. Now, through all this doom and gloom, the book talks about a winning minority, people who actually profit from crashes. Sounds contrarian.
Very contrarian. It mentions leveraged investments that can make huge gains on down days. But, and this is crucial, the first step after selling risky stuff is protection.
Protection first, like treasury bills.
Exactly. Get your defense solid, then maybe think about profiting from the fall.
And one way to do that is with reverse index funds. What are those?
They're designed to go up when the market goes down. So RIDEX URSA tracks the inverse of the S&P 500. RIDEX ARCTOS, the inverse of the NASDAQ 100.
So if the S&P drops 10%, the URSA fund aims to gain 10%.
Roughly, yeah. But it's a direct bet against the market. If the market suddenly rips higher, you lose money. Big time, potentially. Yeah.
Definitely carries risk then. Not for the faint of heart.
No. And it brings us back to Wall Street deception. Tamara Belmont again. Her research getting watered down, suppressed, leading to that dramatic "We LA" message on her real report.
Just highlights the pressure cooker environment, doesn't it? Preventing honest analysis from getting out.
Totally. And it led to this committee forming, trying to expose accounting issues, which then looked at broader economic risks, trying to fight that suppression.
The book mentioned some more obscure stuff, too. Kabushiki Kayash, Stützungskäufe, the plunge protection team. What's that about?
These are basically terms for government or central bank intervention to prop up stock markets.
Like buying stocks directly?
Yeah, Kabushiki Kayash was the Bank of Japan doing that. Stützungskäufe is the German term for similar support buying. The plunge protection team is the informal U.S. name for officials who might coordinate a response during a crash.
Controversial stuff, I imagine.
Very. Does it help? Does it just delay the inevitable? Does it create moral hazard? Lots of debate.
The book makes an interesting comparison. Wall Street firms in 1929 versus 1987 said they were more stable back in 29.
Relatively speaking, yeah. The expert in the book argues that in 29, many big firms had more of their own capital. They could absorb the initial shock better. By 87, Black Monday, firms were way more leveraged, interconnected. A couple of bad days nearly bankrupted some major players.
Shows how the system got more fragile over time.
More complex, more leveraged, definitely more fragile in some ways.
And it uses this analogy. A market correction is like too many tomatoes, but a crash is like the wholesaler's defaulting and the farmer's going broke.
Vivid, isn't it? Shows the difference between a price adjustment and a systemic breakdown.
Then it describes Black Monday 87, the sheer speed of that drop.
Yeah, 508 points on the Dow, equivalent to over 1,800 points today. Just catastrophic speed. Phone lines jammed, sell orders filled, way lower than expected. Pure panic.
And the idea of just shutting down all the markets, is that feasible in a crisis?
The book discusses it. The goal would be to break the panic cycle. Give everyone a breather.
But could it work?
Huge challenges. Markets are global now. If the U.S. shuts down, selling might just shift elsewhere. Plus, shutting markets could even increase fear, right? Spreading panic to other assets? Not easy.
No. And finally, this section mentions short selling high-quality bonds, like treasuries. LTCM did that. How does that work as a hedge?
LTCM used it, yeah. The idea is, in a big crisis, maybe everything falls except the safest government bonds. If you're short those bonds, betting their price will fall, you lose money on that position, but it might offset gains in other parts of your portfolio that are crashing. Or if you think interest rates will spike in a panic, shorting bonds could profit directly.
Complex and risky if you get the rate move wrong.
Very risky. Shorting anything is risky, especially bonds if rates fall instead of rise.
Okay, so shifting gears again. Hidden risks. Derivatives and debt loom large here. The size of the derivatives market, it's just staggering.
Mind-blowing numbers. $50.1 trillion for U.S. commercial banks back then. And the concentration. 96% held by just the top 7 banks.
Wow. And most of it wasn't traded on regulated exchanges.
Over 90% was over-the-counter. Private deals between parties. Less transparency, less oversight. Huge systemic risk if one big player gets into trouble.
And the exposure relative to their capital. J.P. Morgan Chase at 589%, Bank of America 169%, Citibank 199%. What does that even mean?
It means their derivatives positions were multiples of their core capital buffer. For J.P. Morgan, the book calculates, a loss of just 17% on their derivatives could theoretically wipe out all their capital. Shows the extreme leverage involved.
That's terrifying. So the book lays out two crash scenarios, short but ugly and long and choppy.
Yeah, short but ugly is like sharp, deep crash, deflation, pain, but maybe a quicker recovery because deflation eventually restores some buying power.
Okay.
Long and choppy is more like Japan after its bubble burst. Years, even decades of stagnation zombie companies. Both scenarios, though, involved potential 90% market drops and bank shutdowns. Grim stuff.
In deflation, while it sounds good, maybe falling prices, it's bad for debtors.
Right. Really bad. If your income is falling, but your debt payments stay the same, bankruptcies spike. Deflation is often linked to widespread defaults.
And corporate debt was already sky high.
Yeah, $4.9 trillion, over 57% of corporate net worth then. Worse than before the 74 recession, apparently. Makes companies super vulnerable to falling revenues.
So, navigating this. Bonds and options. Corporate bonds seem risky if companies are going bankrupt, right?
You're right.
And rating agencies aren't always reliable. Enron's rating, for instance.
Exactly. Enron had an investment grade rating shortly before it collapsed. Shows you can't blindly trust ratings. Default risk for corporate bonds goes way up in a crisis.
What about put options? How can they help?
Puts give you the right to sell a stock at a set price, the strike price, before a certain date expiration.
So if the stock price tanks below your strike price,
your option becomes valuable. It's in the money. You can potentially profit from the price drop. The book gives examples.
But options expire, right?
Right.
What's the risk?
Huge risk.
Yeah.
You could lose 100% of what you paid for the option if the stock doesn't fall below the strike price by expiration. They're wasting assets.
So rules are important.
Definitely. The book suggests only invest what you can truly afford to lose maybe 5% of your portfolio max. Don't put it all in at once. Maybe buy at least 2 contracts. Sell one if it doubles to cover your cost. Basic risk management.
And it comes back to T-bills again. Just holding those is a safe way to benefit if there's deflation.
Yeah, because the actual purchasing power of your safe dollars increases as prices fall elsewhere. Simplest, safest play.
Okay, then the book describes a second wave of the crash. It's not just tech stocks anymore. Debt unravels, bankruptcy spread, brokerages, insurers, banks.
Right, it becomes systemic. The interconnectedness bites. Problems in one area cascade. Yeah. Even seemingly strong firms can get hit by portfolio losses or just not having enough capital. Money center banks are mentioned as particularly vulnerable.
The UCBS finance arm needing millions daily just to stay afloat. That's a credit crunch symptom, isn't it?
Classic sign. Liquidity dries up. And investment banks like the fictional Harrison Jones get hit too. Underwriting deals vanish. They face losses on their own investments, investor lawsuits, pain everywhere.
And the personal stories. The broker Dubois losing his job, trying to use Tamara's success, finding bad news about himself on the regulator's website.
Yeah, it highlights the human cost. And also how hard it can be for regular people to actually use that broker disclosure data effectively. It's there, but maybe not that helpful in practice sometimes.
So faced with all this potential systemic risk, What actions does the book suggest, protecting yourself from your broker failing?
Yeah, check their safety rating. Again, Weiss ratings are mentioned. Also consider the firm's size bigger isn't always safer, but it's a factor.
And be skeptical of advice.
Hugely skeptical. Given the conflicts of interest, the sheer number of buy ratings, even on failing companies, the book even gave a website, crashprofits.net, to check if your firm recommended stocks that went bankrupt. Basically, don't trust blindly. Seek independent, precise advice.
Makes sense. The book then talks about the blame game during the crisis. Finger pointing.
It always happens, right? Some blame the public for not saving. Others point to systemic failures.
And Tara's analysis got twisted. From crash benefits to crash dangers.
Yeah, manipulated to fit someone else's agenda. It contrasts that with voices calling for long-term fixes and individual responsibility, like the Paul E. Johnston character.
And it gives practical steps for individuals.
Yeah. Cut up credit cards, pay more than the minimum on debt, pay down loans and mortgages aggressively. Basic financial hygiene, but crucial. Also, check your employer's financial health using ratings agencies. Try to protect your job.
But it still ends on a note of hope for the U.S.
Yeah, despite the grim scenarios, there's an underlying belief in the potential for recovery.
Okay, almost there. Trying to time the bottom. Famously hard.
Yeah.
The shuttle bus analogy.
Right, like opportunities come along. You don't have to catch the very first one or the absolute bottom. Wait for confirmation, maybe. But then there's that chilling warning from the character Gabriel.
About an Argentina-style collapse in America.
Yeah, a really stark reminder of how bad things could theoretically get, even in a developed country. Underscores the need to always keep some assets safe, liquid, even when you start thinking about recovery.
And watch interest rates for signals.
Interest rate moves can definitely signal shifts in market sentiment and economic direction.
Right. Okay, the final section before the end, the darkest day. It talks about a general holiday, shutting down everything. Banks, markets, factories.
Like FDR did briefly in the Depression. A truly radical last resort measure.
Why?
To stop a complete uncontrolled panic. If everything is effectively shut down anyway, banks aren't lending, factories aren't producing, markets are frozen, a formal pause might be needed to regain control, restore some faith, implement drastic fixes.
Wow. Desperate times.
The book paints a picture of total breakdown transportation, communication failing. But even then, it argues, financially sound companies will still exist, gives examples of highly rated insurers.
So even in the worst case, there are survivors. Okay, let's try to wrap this up. Boiling down this whole deep dive into crash profits, What are the absolute key takeaways for you, our listener?
Well, I think we've really seen how history can offer clues about market crashes, right? We saw the dangers of hype, corporate misconduct, and especially massive amounts of debt. Deflation's role, too.
Yeah.
And crucially, we talked about strategies, protecting yourself, treasury bills being the baseline safe asset, understanding risks, like with corporate bonds or options, and just being really, really careful about where you get financial advice.
Definitely. So your mission, listening in, was to get a clearer handle on these dynamics, these potential pitfalls and strategies. Hopefully you feel a bit more equipped, maybe less overwhelmed by it all.
Yeah, and maybe this leaves you with a final thought to chew on. Given everything we've talked about, the history, the potential for surprises, what steps can you take starting today to make your own financial plan more resilient? You know, tougher, ready for whatever the market throws your way, up or down.
Good question. Mm. Really encourages you to think critically about your own situation. Do some more digging.
Absolutely.
All right. Until our next deep dive, stay informed and stay thoughtful.